We went to court to challenge the suspension, but we lost. Rohrabach appealed to a higher court and won. But I didn't want to miss more of the season in court. I wanted to play hockey. So I had two choices. I could go home, or I could play for the high school team at Upper Canada College, a private school in Toronto. I didn't really want to do either. Luckily, the coach of the Nats Junior B team, where Murray Howe played, which is a level higher than minor hockey, invited me to come watch her practice. So, of course, I went. I was about 5'6" at the time and weighed about 120 pounds. Those Junior B guys looked huge. But after practice, the coach said, "You know, you could play here." I nervously told him, "Yeah, I think I can." My dad just said, "Oh my God, you're going to get killed." Playing there changed my life in a lot of ways, and it also changed my game. One of the most exciting players in the NHL back then was Bobby Clark. He wasn't a big guy, but he played fearlessly, and part of that was because he played smart. Jean Popiel gave me some great advice. He told me to watch the way Clark played, particularly in the corners and behind the net, and especially on the power play. Back then, if you were wearing a Toronto Marlies jacket, you could get a standing room ticket to a Leafs game for a dollar. So whenever the Flyers were in town, I would take the subway down to Maple Leaf Gardens to see Bobby Clark take the warm-up. And then I would pay careful attention to when the Flyers were on the power play. Clark could control the pace by positioning himself in the seams of the defensive coverage. If guys started chasing him, the seams would only get bigger, and someone would be open. And of course, when he was behind the net, no one could touch him. Whenever someone asks me how I started controlling the offense from behind the net, the only honest answer is that I studied Bobby Clark doing it. And it worked pretty well for me. In 1981, I scored 50 goals in 39 games. Five of those came in the 39th game against Philadelphia. I talked to a lot of people in the dressing room afterward, and it took quite a while to get ready to leave. When the dust settled a little, one of the trainers told me that Bobby Clark wanted to say hello. I just couldn't believe that Clark had waited all that time to have a word with me. It was incredibly gracious, and I'll never forget what he said. "You know, with Bobby Orr, at least I knew where he was out there. With you, I can't even find you half the time." He was laughing, of course, but it was still a huge compliment coming from someone I admired so much growing up. Clark went on to become one of the most respected executives in the league and was appointed to run Team Canada for the 1998 Olympics in Nagano, which means he was probably the most respected hockey mind in Canada. He and I would have coffee every morning for a couple of hours in the Olympic Village with Bob Gainey, another very smart hockey player and executive, with his fair share of Stanley Cup rings. We would talk about the old times, and players we knew, and the young guys coming up. When you're talking hockey with guys who love the game, time stands still. Philadelphia is a sports town. The league was looking for television markets, and thanks to the city's three professional teams in football, baseball, and basketball, Philadelphia was already the fourth largest television market in the country. The NFL's Philadelphia Eagles had been around since 1933. Baseball's Phillies, the oldest sports team with the same name in the same city in the United States, got their start in 1883. And basketball's 76ers had been in the city since 1963. As a matter of fact, Philadelphia had already had an NHL team before 1967. The Philadelphia Quakers lasted for all of one season in 1930-31. Their record was 4-36-4, which still stands as a record for fewest wins by an NHL team. Not surprisingly, the fans weren't interested. When Ed Snyder, part owner of the Eagles and my eventual neighbor and friend, heard about the NHL expansion, He was sure he could make it work. The 76ers, who'd picked up Wilt Chamberlain in 1965 and won the NBA championship in 1967, wanted a new building, which could double as a hockey arena. So Snyder partnered up with his brother-in-law, Jerry Schiff, Bill Putnam, a young New York financial advisor, and another Eagles owner, Jerry Wolfman. They put in a bid and acquired the franchise. GM Bud Poile hired Keith Allen to coach. Snyder bought the American Hockey League's Quebec Aces for $350,000 to kickstart the team and got some great players. Guys like André Lacroix, Jean-Guy Gendron, and Bill Sutherland. Then Allen spent a year scouting the original six, and in the expansion draft, they got Bernie Parent in goal and then two solid defensemen, Ed Van Impe and Joe Watson. In other words, they did what many smart teams do. They built from back to front. On opening day, they held a parade down Broad Street with the players sitting on top of convertibles as they made their way to the Spectrum. Ed always said that there were more people in the parade than actually watching it. That would change sooner than anyone thought, but they still had some tough luck ahead of them. On March 1st of their first season, a storm tore part of the roof off their brand new building, and so they had to play their last seven home games on the road. They finished first in the Western Division, but lost to St. Louis in a seven-game semifinal. In their second season, they were eliminated by the Blues once again, only this time they were swept. Noel Picard, the Blues defenseman immortalized in the famous photo of Bobby Orr flying through the air after scoring his most famous goal, and the Plager brothers were really hard on the Philadelphia players. As Ed watched his team get shoved around, he told Keith Allen that they would never be out-muscled like that again. The first Universal Amateur draft year was 1969. Bobby Clark, who played for Manitoba's Flin Flon Bombers, had been ripping up the Western Canada Hockey League for 2 years, winning the scoring title both years and being named MVP in 1969. He had also won the scoring title and the MVP award 2 years earlier when the Bombers were playing in a different league. The WCHL was incredibly tough hockey, and absolutely nothing slowed Clark down. He was unstoppable. Or almost. When he was 14, he was diagnosed with diabetes. He'd learned how to inject himself with insulin, and no one who saw him play ever doubted his energy levels. But the diabetes scared off the GMs. The draft was held in the Queen Elizabeth Hotel in Montreal. In those days, it wasn't the big event that it is now. Today, a team will host the draft in its arena with hundreds of team personnel and thousands of fans in the stands. The entire first round is covered on live national television, and all the top picks show up with their families and their agents. Back then, though, the GMs just sat around a table and had a time limit of 3 minutes per pick. The scouts would phone up the picks and invite them to training camp in the fall. Despite dominating junior for 3 years, Clark went unclaimed in the first round. The Flyers took Bob Currier. He never played a game in the NHL. Although scouts were raving about this kid who had been dominating junior for 3 years, teams were scared off by Clark's diabetes. Bobby's coach, Pat Ginnell, had taken him down to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, figuring that a clean report from the doctors there would turn the NHL GMs around. It didn't. But Ed Snyder had done his homework. He made a call to a doctor in Philadelphia who told him that as long as Bobby lived a healthy lifestyle, there would be no problem. So Snyder told Bud Poile to go for it. The Flyers picked Clark in the second round, 17th overall. As soon as Philadelphia took Bobby, the other teams figured the Flyers must have known something they didn't. Detroit Red Wings head scout Jimmy Skinner came up to Keith Allen and Bud Poile and offered 4 good players for Bobby. Poile said, "No thanks." Later, Sam Pollock called Ed Snyder and offered him 5 players and 2 top draft picks for Bobby. Ed said, "No way." Pollock said he agreed that it was a smart move to keep him. And it was. Clark turned out to be one of the great steals in draft history. No one in his draft year came close to matching his impact in the league. But Clark had a rough start in the NHL. He fainted in one of the workouts at training camp. The coaching staff got nervous. A few practices later, it happened again. Luckily, the team trainer, Frank Lewis, knew something about diabetes. When Bobby admitted that he was skipping breakfast, Lewis put him on a diet of energy-rich foods, including candy bars and orange juice with sugar cubes stirred in. Personally, I loved the concession food. I'd have a couple of hot dogs an hour or so before the game, and maybe some popcorn and a Coke. I remember guys in the locker room eating pizza. I also remember Guy Lafleur chain-smoking cigarettes between periods at the 1981 Canada Cup. Gordie Howe would sometimes play a game on a chocolate milkshake. We just had no idea about nutrition. In the 5th and 6th round that year, the Flyers picked up 2 big guys from Saskatchewan, Dave Schultz and Don Selesky. And that was the beginning of the Broad Street Bullies. After all, Ed Snyder had made it clear. The Flyers would never get manhandled by St. Louis or anybody else ever again. Fred Shiro was hired as the Flyers coach in 1971. Fred was a real pioneer in the game. He'd have the guys practice with a tennis ball to sharpen their stick handling touch and reflexes. He'd also have them bunny hop up and down the ice to loud music in order to build their legs. Things like that made the guys laugh and brought them closer together. The exercises also made them better. Shiro treated his players like men. He encouraged them to argue with him if they didn't agree with his methods, and if somebody screwed up, he didn't punish the whole team. He would just sit the guy on the bench for a couple of days. The experience was so embarrassing that the player wouldn't do it again. In 1972, the Flyers made a 7-player deal with Los Angeles. It included a guy who had become a good friend and mentor to me, Bill Flett. Jack Kent Cook had nicknamed him Cowboy, and that's what everyone called him. Cowboy Flett was 200 pounds and over 6 feet. Very powerful, all arms and chest. His hands were huge, and he had a strong grip. But he was a gentle big man. He wasn't mean, but he was strong. No way could you move him if he didn't want to be moved. He wore a thick, bushy beard that had to be hot as hell, although he always kept it nice and clean. For 2 years, 78 to 79 and 79 to 80, I'd sit beside him on the plane when we played together in Edmonton. I remember he smelled like soap, beer, and horses. Cowboy was a bit of a tragic figure. His dad was Meyer Flett, quite a hockey player himself for the Turner Valley Oilers in the early 1940s. Meyer was a hard man, an oil field worker. He played senior hockey with Calgary Flames trainer Bearcat Murray, who tells this story. After a game once, when everyone was having a shower, Flett walked past Bearcat, who nudged his buddy and said, "Look at Meyer." Flett was bruised back in blue from top to bottom. That's the kind of game he played. Nobody fooled with him, especially not his son. The Kings traded Bill to Philadelphia when he was 28, a big, strong winger who hadn't scored very much. Then he was paired with Bobby Clark and put up 74 points. Bill hadn't much cared for liquor until he moved to Los Angeles in his early 20s and became a beer drinker. By the time he joined the Flyers, he'd had his oilcloth duster custom-made with about 8 big pockets on the inside, and he kept a beer in each one. Cowboy was Bobby Clark's roommate on the road. They'd go out and have dinner together, and Bobby would make sure he got in on time at night. In those days, you could have a couple beers the night before a game, and nobody cared. Cowboy may have needed guidance off the ice, but certainly not on the ice. He really gave it to the goaltenders. If he came down the wing and had a clear shot, not even a scoring opportunity, but a clear shot, he'd try to hit the goalie in the head. His theory was that when he came down the next time, the goalie would figure he was going to shoot it high, but instead he just slid it along the ice. That's how smart he was. It wasn't that he was the fastest or the toughest, but he took being a hockey player very seriously. He partied and all the rest of it, but he was never off his game. He always came up big. Philadelphia won the Stanley Cup in 1974, the first expansion team to do so. In Game 2 of the finals, the Flyers were in Boston, 12 minutes into overtime. Cowboy came up the middle and assisted Bobby Clark to beat them. It was a great play, and it turned things around for the Flyers. Remember, no expansion team had ever won a cup. And in the Flyers' previous 19 regular season visits to Boston Garden, they hadn't won once. They gave Boston everything they could handle in Game 1. But just when it looked as though they had gone ahead late in the third, Bobby Orr single-handedly saved the goal, then went the other way to score. Nothing was going to be easy for Philadelphia. It was Clark who finally broke through in Game 2, and it was Clark who led the rest of the way as the first expansion team hoisted the cup. Though it was Bernie Parent, who the Bruins had left unprotected in the expansion draft, who won the Conn Smythe as playoff MVP. Clark led again in 1974-75, and Dave Schultz set a record for penalty minutes, and the Flyers won a second straight cup. That year they squared off against Buffalo in the first ever matchup of expansion teams in the final. Game 3 of that series is still talked about today as the Fog Game, as a May heat wave created so much fog at ice level at the auditorium in Buffalo that players couldn't see the puck. Officials had to ask them to skate in circles to dissipate the fog. The Flyers lost that game, and the next, but roared back on home ice in Game 5 and closed the series out on the road, thanks to another shutout from Bernie Parent. The Flyers haven't won another cup since then, though Pat Quinn coached them to the final in 1980, and Eric Lindros brought them close again in 1997. But they have become one of the most respected teams in the league. Since 1967, only the Montreal Canadiens have won a higher percentage of their games than the Flyers. And Bobby Clark has been a huge part of that history of success. He holds franchise records for most games played, most playoff games played, most points, most playoff points, best plus-minus, and many others. He is also fourth all-time in penalty minutes. He played in 8 All-Star games, won the Hart Trophy, Most Valuable Player, 3 times, as well as the Selke Trophy, Top Defensive Forward, the Ted Lindsay Award, formerly the Lester B. Pearson Award, given to the top regular season player as voted by other players, and many more. Just as importantly, when Clark retired, he stepped right into management and has done as much to steer the Flyers over their impressive history than anyone. Some players are defined by their teams, but the Flyers have definitely been defined by Bobby Clark. I think the reason Ed Snyder and I got along so well was that we wanted to beat each other. I had so much fun with him over the years, especially after I retired. He got a real kick out of talking about the Flyers with me, because I know so much of their history. He was good friends with David Foster, the music producer, and I've known David since 1979. He once invited Janet and me to a dinner at Christmas time, along with Ed and his wife, and some of David's other friends. David loves to get on the piano and sing, and everyone joins in. David always says, "I can make anyone sound good, except Wayne." Anyway, at this dinner we were all singing when David shook his head and said, "I didn't think it was possible, but Ed's worse than Wayne." Ed Snyder died this past spring. It was a sad day for hockey. He made such a great contribution to the Flyers and to the league. I remember a conversation we had where he summed up the three things that had changed the franchise. Number one was that they went into the community and started programs for kids to play youth hockey. Number two was when they lost to St. Louis and then made the team tougher. And then Ed said, Number three, Wayne, was when we drafted a guy named Bob Clark. Chapter 24. The World Hockey Association. Looking back now, the World Hockey Association probably looks pretty crazy. The franchises that came and went, the wild hair and the wild fights. It was pretty different from the game we know today, and the game that came before it. But I honestly think the WHA was good for hockey. For one thing, the on-ice product was actually surprisingly good. Any league with stars like Bobby Hull, Dave Keon, Gordie Howe, and Jerry Cheevers is a pretty serious league. The WHA players hung in there with the Russians in 1974, and whenever a WHA team squared off with an NHL team in an exhibition game, they more than held their own. Part of that was a result of the WHA's openness to European players and the style of play they brought with them, and part of it was the fact that by raiding junior teams, they were injecting youth into their lineups. Think of the impact that some 18-year-olds have in the NHL today. That should give some idea of the effect that guys like Mike Gartner, Rod Langway, Mark Messier, and Mark Howe had in the WHA as teenagers. Youth wasn't really part of the game before then. The other benefit to the game was that it opened up a lot of new jobs for players and raised their salaries. The fact is, I wouldn't have had a job playing hockey at the age of 17 if it hadn't been for the new league. A lot of those teams had great fans. People in Winnipeg, Quebec City, Edmonton, and Hartford knew hockey. Those were great rinks to play in. Even Cincinnati and Indianapolis were close enough to Detroit and Chicago that fans knew the game and appreciated it. Now, until the mid-80s, hockey wasn't widely broadcast on television in the United States. So if you didn't grow up with hockey, you probably didn't know what was going on at ice level. Even when the Atlanta Thrashers started up in the 1990s, people used to joke that fans would cheer whenever a team iced the puck. But who can blame them? If you've never seen a hockey game, icing probably looks like a great idea. And it's true that we saw some crazy things in places like Binghamton, where fighting seemed to be a big part of the Bulls' marketing. But on the whole, hockey fans should be glad the WHA was there when it was. The WHA started up in 1971, with its first games played in October 1972. The 12-team hockey league was the idea of American promoters Dennis Murphy and Gary Davidson, both from California. They'd seen it done in 1960 when the American Football League was formed to take on the NFL, and were directly involved in the American Basketball Association when it took on the NBA in 1967. Now they wanted to do the same with hockey, but they knew nothing about hockey. They hadn't even seen a game. So they recruited Wild Bill Hunter to help them out. Hunter was the president of Edmonton's junior team, the Oil Kings. Before that, he founded the Western Canada Junior Hockey League, which became the WHL. Juniors now call it the Dub, for W. Because Hunter knew a lot of people in the hockey world, he traveled all over North America looking for investors to buy franchises for $25,000 each. One of his first investors was Ben Hatskin, who'd played football for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers and won two Grey Cups in 1939 and 41. In 1967, during the NHL expansion, Hatskin had tried for an NHL franchise, but NHL president Clarence Campbell told him he'd need a 16,000-seat rink and a $2 million entry fee. Hatskin thought that was too steep. In order to bring in good players, and the fans who would follow, The fledgling WHA needed to begin with stars. And fortunately for them, the NHL itself paved the way. Although average NHL salaries were competitive with those in other pro sports, top hockey stars were paid less than top stars in baseball and basketball. So the WHA owners figured they'd be able to recruit a few great players from the NHL. And they were right. By 1972, the WHA's second year, 67 players had jumped from the NHL. But the WHA still needed a big name. Gordie Howe was retired, and there were really only a handful of active players in hockey everybody knew. Players like Phil Esposito, Bobby Orr, Bobby Clark, and Bobby Hull. The trouble was that most of them were tied up in contracts. Except the Chicago Blackhawks' Bobby Hull. At 33, he was still in really good shape with many good years ahead, and he was a huge hockey star. Bobby Hull had already scored 604 NHL goals. Only Gordie Howe had scored more. Hull had led the league in goals 7 out of 10 years in the 1960s, and he had one of the hardest slap shots in the history of hockey, shooting the puck at 120 miles per hour. Who does that? No one. Shea Weber can shoot the puck hard enough to go right through the mesh, which he did at the 2010 Olympics against Germany. And he has never been clocked at anywhere near 120, even at the All-Star game, where he is allowed a running start and a stiffer stick than he uses in real games. Bernie Parent says there were times when Bobby's shot would rebound so hard off the glass or the end boards that his own goalie would have to make the save. He used to amuse teammates by firing pucks over the boards and down the tunnels and trying to break the glass doors of the old Chicago Stadium. Ben Hatskin offered Bobby $250,000 a year for 5 years with his new Winnipeg franchise, plus another $100,000 a year to coach or manage for 5 years after that. Bobby said no thanks. He wanted to stay in Chicago. He really liked Chicago and had played there for 15 years. But he was having problems negotiating his contract with Bill Wirtz. Attendance was dropping at Blackhawks games. Fans could watch the White Sox and Cubs, the Bears, and the Bulls home games on television, but not the Blackhawks. Even though Hawks games had been on TV as early as the 1940s, certainly before Hockey Night in Canada, Wirtz refused to televise most of his home games because he thought it would mean fewer ticket sales. Later, when Chicago did decide to air their home games, their fan base grew. So did their crowds at the arena. In any case, he was in no mood to open the bank for Hull. Hatskin continued to call Bobby's agent, Harvey Weinberg. Finally, just to get Ben off his back, Bobby said he thought the $250,000 a year for 5 years was fine, but that he wanted $1 million signing bonus up front. He thought it would never fly, because no one had ever been paid that much to play any sport, let alone get it up front. Hatskin said yes. To acquire a star of Bobby's caliber would give the WHA the instant credibility it needed. So each of the first 10 owners kicked in $110,000 and raised the million. It was a huge deal in hockey, one of the biggest ever. When it came out that Bobby was going over to the WHA, Bill's father, Arthur Wirtz, who owned the Hawks, sent over a contract for $1,250,000. But Bobby says he told him to stick it where the sun don't shine. The WHA owners cost the NHL owners a lot of money and changed the game forever. For the first time since the Western Hockey League folded in 1926, a rival league had the power to compete with the NHL for elite players. Legal challenges arose involving the reserve clause in NHL contracts, which restricted a player's movement for the rest of his life. But the courts ruled that once a player's contract was finished, and several NHL players were on single-season contracts in 1972, a player was free to sign with the team that held his rights, in either league. This was the beginning of multi-year deals to keep a player's rights. Several NHL stars followed Bobby into the WHA, including goalies Jerry Cheevers from Boston and Bernie Parent from Toronto, defenseman Ted Green and J.C. Tremblay, and an exciting young center named Derek Sanderson. Before the WHA, the players had no voice. The teams called the shots because there was no one else to negotiate with. That's why you always hear the story about Glenn Hall threatening to take a year off to paint his barn instead. It turned out that there was no barn. That was just Glenn negotiating. The players had no power at all. It was the WHA that finally gave them some bargaining power. Meanwhile, the NHL thought that if they ignored the league, it would go away. Consider the case of Tom Webster. Webster had played pretty well in Detroit, and then got traded to the California Golden Seals. Then, when Webster's Seals contract was up, Howard Baldwin, part owner of the WHA's New England Whalers, offered him a 3-year deal for over $50,000 a year guaranteed. At the time, it was a lot of money. Tom was making only $12,000 a year with the Seals. So he called Mr. Finley and said, "The WHA has drafted me and offered me a 3-year contract, and I'm considering taking it." Mr. Finley said, "Well, son," if he liked you, he called you son, "why don't you fly down and meet me here in Chicago?" Webster jumped on a plane, flew into Chicago, went to Finley's office, and showed him his contract. Finley read it over. "Well, son, listen, it's a very good offer. I don't blame you for looking at it. But you know what? I've had experience with this kind of stuff in baseball. Do you remember the Pasquales?" Webster said he didn't. What Finley was talking about was a Mexican league. In 1946, Jorge Pasquale brought major leaguers to Mexico. He offered them huge contracts. Players like Ted Williams, Bob Feller, and Stan Musial. Those boys stayed home. But some did go to Mexico, like Brooklyn Dodgers catcher Mickey Owen and Giants second baseman George Houseman. 27 major leaguers all moved down to Mexico. But after just 1 year, it all started to come apart when the league couldn't pay some of the players. So they headed home. And of course, when they came back, the money was much, much less than what they'd been making before they left. Finley asked, "How much are you making now?" "Well, last year you paid me $12,000. I think I'll pay you $11,000 to come back and play for me next year." "Sir, this is a legitimate contract here. I'm not trying to pull any punches or lie to you or BS you." "Yeah, I understand that. But I told you, I had this experience. $11,000 now. Much less if you have to come back." Webster stood up. "Thank you very much, sir, but I'm going over to the WHA." After Bobby Hull went to Winnipeg and others began to follow, NHL general managers started calling their star players and offering to raise their salaries. Agents weren't above taking advantage. In August 1975, when Bobby Orr's contract with the Boston Bruins was up at the end of the coming season, his agent, Alan Eagleson, began negotiating with the Bruins. But the Bruins were lowballing, so Eagleson went looking for other opportunities. The WHA's Minnesota Fighting Saints president, Wayne Belisle, offered Bobby a multi-million dollar contract with a $1 million signing bonus. Eagleson turned it down. He was just looking for leverage. But there were other true legends of the game who did make the jump to the new league. Dave Keon played in the WHA, as did Frank Mahovlich, Paul Henderson, Kent Nielsen. And then there was Gordie Howe, who came out of retirement to play with his sons. I was at a 2015 Kinsmen dinner in Saskatoon honoring Gordie Howe when Mark told the story about him at that first training camp. He said he remembered Gordie huffing and puffing and turning 15 shades of purple. The boys thought he was going to have a heart attack. but Mark said that his dad had incredible stamina. A week later, they couldn't keep up with him. And the special part, he added, was seeing bodies flying around his dad, even in practice. Terry O'Malley, who played on 3 Canadian Olympic hockey teams, was once talking with Danny O'Shea, a checker who played against Gordy in Minnesota. Terry said, "It's amazing he can play at such an age." And Danny replied, "I could play at 52 if I had 15 feet on each side of me whenever I got the puck." Terry Ruskowski was drafted by the Blackhawks, but signed with the Houston Aeros instead, because Gordy was there. Just before playoffs, they were playing scrimmage, and although Terry knew he shouldn't do it, he put the puck between Gordy's legs and stepped around him. Gordy turned and rapped Terry with his stick right above the eye, cut him for about 4 or 5 stitches. There was blood all over the place, and the trainer had to run out with a towel. Gordy tapped his stick on Terry's pants in a friendly way and said, "Hey, sorry about that, kid." And then in a quiet voice he added, "Don't ever make me look bad." Gordy always wanted to be the best. He hated to lose, and he was the ultimate teammate. In Houston, he would fight guys, make plays, score goals. Everyone knew that when the game was on the line, you could sit back because Gordy would be taking over. Other young guys, like Morris Lukowich, whose brother Ed is a former world curling champion, were offered similar contracts from both leagues. But like Terry, Morris chose the WHA because of Gordy. Gordy was interested in helping younger guys, but he demanded respect and good manners. Morris would sit beside him in the dressing room and on the bench just because he loved being near him. When Gordy would get ready to go on for his shift, he'd have sweat pouring off him, but instead of using his own sweater, he'd always lean to his right and wipe his forehead on the jersey of the guy next to him. Morris has said that the first time Gordy did it to him, he thought, "Wow, I'm hitting the big time." If Gordy was tired between periods, he'd sit back in his stall and sleep through intermission, or he'd open up his fan mail, read it, sign it, and hand one of the younger players the envelope to lick it. Morris says he licked so much glue that he'd be dizzy going out for the next period. In 1979, the final season of the WHA, I was 17 years old. It was my first season of pro hockey, and I was just thrilled to be there. I was having a pretty good year with the Edmonton Oilers. We were in first place, and I was 5th in the scoring race and starting to find my way. I hadn't expected to get picked for the 3-game All-Star Series against the HC Dynamo Moscow, a pro team from Russia. But Edmonton was hosting, so that probably helped me get on the team. Jacques Demers, who'd go on to coach in the NHL for 14 years and win a Stanley Cup with the Canadiens in 1993, was the assistant coach of the All-Star team. In those days, everything was run so differently. The team wasn't put together by the media or a panel. I think Jacques pretty much handpicked the players himself. So when he called me, I knew it was a great honor. I went down to the locker room one day ahead of our first game, thinking, "If I dress tomorrow, great. If I don't, I'm 17, I understand." The trainer told me, "Jacques Demers wants to see you." I walked into his office. Gordy Howe and Mark Howe were there too. I'd already developed a friendship with Gordy, but I was still really nervous. Demers said, "You're going to center Mark and Gordy." I was kind of shocked. I thought, "Oh my gosh, I'm playing, and I'm playing with Gordy Howe." We practiced, and the next day we had a light skate. When we got to arena that night before the game, I was really scared. I was sitting in my stall, and at one point I turned to Gordy to ask him a question, but his eyes were closed. He was having a nap. "Gordy?" "Gordy, I'm really nervous about this game." He opened one eye, looked at me, and said, "So am I." In the end, we won 4-2, and our line had 8 points. But for me, the real thrill was just lining up for the face-off beside Mr. Hockey. I remember how well guys like Paul Schmier, Rob Ramage, Morris Lukowich, Robbie Fatorik, and Mike Gartner played on that 1979 All-Star team. And I got to spend 4 days with Dave Keon, the great Maple Leafs captain in the 1960s. Keon had been a junior B player at St. Michael's College in Toronto, where he was coached by Father David Bauer, who founded the Canadian men's national Olympic team. He also happened to be the brother of future Hall of Famer Bobby Bauer of the Bruins Kraut line. At a practice one day, Father Bauer began a backwards skating checking drill. But Keon couldn't do it. He was a river skater, a beautiful skater, but not a checker. Father Bauer wasn't letting him off the hook. Finally, Keon said, "I'm not doing this anymore. I'm done." They had a real argument. And then finally, Father Bauer kicked him off the ice and marched him into the dorm. When they got there, Father Bauer said, "I'll tell you what. Let's wrestle. And if I pin you, you practice my checking drills. If you win, you don't have to." Keon agreed, and they went at it. Father Bauer won, and Dave Keon went on to become one of the great two-way players in the game. When he played for the Leafs, he was checking Gordie Howe one time and had him in the corner. He wasn't riding Gordie or anything, but he was controlling his space, and then finally pinned him. Finally, Gordie had enough. He turned back to him and said, "Look, kid, remember, the elbows come back fast." Everybody always talks about good scorers or good defensive rushers, but good checkers get kind of overlooked. The fundamental behind a great check is that you close the distance between you and the player with the puck. You have an angle. Your head is up. You're looking at his chest. And when he stops and changes direction, you have to be able to stop and recover and then close the gap again. That's the kind of checking that Father Bauer introduced. That's how elite defensemen can play almost half the game. They're not chasing guys around the ice. They're just maintaining their gap. So playing with Keon was my link to Father Bauer and the Kraut line. I was always grateful that Jacques Demers gave me that opportunity. Several established NHL stars moved over to WHA teams in those first few seasons. Pat Stapleton from Chicago, Mark Tardif, Réjean Houla, and Frank Mahovlich from Montreal, and Paul Henderson from Toronto. The WHA also took on good junior players who were too young to sign with NHL teams. I've already talked about how you had to be 20 to qualify for the NHL draft. So when you were 17, 18, 19, and someone offered to pay you to play pro hockey, it was hard to say no. Nelson Skalbania, the owner of the Indianapolis Racers, signed me in June 1978. He signed Mark Messier later the same year. I got to Indianapolis at the end of August, because that's when school started. One of the deals I'd made with my dad when I turned pro at 17 was that I would go to school until I turned 18. So I signed up for night school twice a week. Broad Ripple High. David Letterman went there. I made a lot of friends my age, which was good, because the guys on the team were a lot older. One of them even had a baby. Fridays before hockey season, our goalie Eddie Mio and winger Peter Driscoll would roll up to the Steak and Shake in Peter's new baby blue Biarritz Cadillac. It was his pride and joy. Drisk and Eddie looked like Starsky and Hutch. Drisk had a black shag and wore long, pointy collars and an Indian red leather jacket. He was a big, rugged guy who could really play. The season before, 1977 to 78, he'd had 56 points, 46 with Indianapolis and 10 with Quebec. But he was also our tough guy in Indianapolis. Peter's nickname was Grenade, because he didn't have the softest hands and tended to shoot wide. But you had to be careful about calling him that. He had to be in a certain mood. Eddie was blonde with a cool mustache and sideburns. He always wore a light calf leather jacket and a black t-shirt with bell-bottom jeans. Years later, he told me that the jacket was actually made of plastic because he couldn't afford the real deal. Didn't matter. He still looked sharp. Our GM and coach, Pat Stapleton, or Whitey, as everyone called him, had told Peter and Eddie, "Hey, there's a kid coming up, Wayne Gretzky. He's going to be billeted right around the corner from you guys, so check in with him once in a while until the season starts." That's why the two of them would drive up to the Steak and Shake on Friday nights. They'd call out, "Hey, everything okay?" I'd wave at them, "Yeah," and they'd drive off. I wasn't a hit in Indianapolis. I remember my first mall signing. Three people showed up. Eight games in, Drisk and Eddie and I were on a plane to Canada. We'd been traded. Peter Driscoll was a key player in the trade because it gave Edmonton a power winger they didn't have. Edmonton had Dave Semenko, who could fight anybody. He could play hockey too, but he wasn't a power winger like Peter. The Oilers were also looking for a goalie. They had Dave Dryden, but he was getting older, and they wanted another guy to back him, so they went after Eddie Mio. It was a package deal. Three players for $250,000. When we'd gotten off the ice after practice in Indianapolis, we were told to grab some basics and get on a plane. So we had maybe two suitcases each. We were on this little Learjet 25. The three of us with our hockey equipment. Those small Lears don't have any undercarriages. They're basically puddle jumpers. We were squeezed in. Eddie and Peter were sitting on their equipment. We were all in a daze. I was a very nervous flyer, but the guys didn't know it. So they told me to sit at the back on a little jump seat. Eddie looked over and saw me shaking pretty bad. He opened the cooler and handed me a sandwich and a beer. He said, "It's okay, kid. I don't think there's any air police going to check your ID." We weren't even sure where we were going. Maybe Edmonton, maybe Winnipeg. Still, I'd known the trade was coming. A few weeks earlier, after a game against the Jets, their stick boy had come up to me and said, "Bobby Hull wants to talk to you." So I went to dinner with Bobby. He said, "Would you like to play in Winnipeg for the Jets? They're going to trade you." He told me that they were going after me and our coach, Pat Stapleton. So there I am, 17 years old, and Bobby Hull is asking me if I want to play with him. I said, "Wow, okay, sure." The day after that was a Monday. We went home, and the Racers' owner, Nelson Scalbania, called and told me that I had two choices, Winnipeg or Edmonton. My agent, Gus Badali, advised me to go to Edmonton. He said that the NHL and WHA were going to merge, and that since Winnipeg's arena could hold only 11,000 people, whereas Edmonton's could hold 16,000, Edmonton had a much better shot at getting into the NHL. Going to Edmonton would be a good business decision, but playing with Bobby Hull would have been great too. In any case, Bobby hadn't given up. He and Nelson were still negotiating while we were on the plane. We had to stop in Minneapolis to refuel. At that point, the pilot told us that we were heading to Edmonton. Jets GM Rudy Pillis had passed on the deal. He thought I wasn't good enough to play pro hockey. The very existence of the WHA and speculation about its longevity could influence contract negotiations within the NHL. Montreal Canadiens GM Sam Pollock's deal with Guy Lafleur is one example. In 1971, Sam had banked on the California Golden Seals, formerly known as the Oakland Seals, coming in last. So he traded Ernie Hickey and his 1970 first-round draft pick to the Seals for Francois Lacombe and their first-round pick. But the Hickey brothers started to gel, and the Seals started winning. That meant the LA Kings were going to come in last place. Sam had to make the LA Kings stronger, so he traded center Ralph Backstrom, a guy who averaged 40 to 50 points, to Los Angeles, in exchange for Gore Labossiere and Ray Fortin. just as Pollock had hoped. L.A. started winning, and the Seals came in last place. Sam used his first overall pick to draft Guy Lafleur. By the spring of 1973, Lafleur had just finished his second season with the Canadiens. That's when the WHA's Quebec Nordiques, Guy's father-in-law was one of their directors, offered Guy a three-year, $450,000 contract. Now, Sam Pollock had gone through a lot of trouble to get Guy Lafleur, and there was no way he wanted to lose him to the WHA. The trouble was that he couldn't pay $150,000 a year. That was way above the salaries of the other players. On top of which, Guy wasn't even playing as much as some of the other 1971 draft picks on the team. Pollock decided to offer Guy $1 million for a 10-year contract for $100,000 a year. But first he called his coach, Scotty Bowman, and his assistant, Claude Ruel. A 10-year contract was unheard of at the time, and so Sam wanted to know whether they thought a lesser team would eventually want Guy in a trade. Bowman said he didn't know how good Guy would be because he hadn't played up to his potential, but that he was confident Guy would always be an NHL player, not a superstar. Claude, who scouted Guy in the first place, was more attuned to his possibilities. He said, "He will develop." So Pollock offered Guy the contract, and because Guy wasn't sure whether the WHA would survive, he signed it. Guy Lafleur would go on to win 5 Stanley Cups with Montreal. Larry Robinson, who'd won all those cups with Lafleur and had signed as a free agent with the Kings a year after I got there, told us how amazed he'd been by him. Robinson said that as long as you pass the puck in Guy's direction, whether it was off his skates or on either side, he'd somehow find it. They say there is no such thing as a bad pass to a good player, but Lafleur was truly phenomenal. And Guy was explosive, so he could move away from a hit like a fly. Years later, I'd have the opportunity and the privilege to play on Flower's line at the 1981 Canada Cup. When the WHA added 2 teams for the 1974-75 season, the NHL responded in a defensive move by adding the Atlanta Flames and the New York Islanders. That meant 32 teams in total, and since almost all the players were from Canada, the talent level was getting thin. Teams started to look to Europe, mostly Sweden and Finland, as well as to a few defectors from Czechoslovakia. No players behind the Iron Curtain were free to leave at that time. The Jets brought over 2 Swedes, Ulf Nilsson and Anders Hedberg, to play on Bobby Hull's line, and together they were pretty special. Really entertaining. They played the game with crisscrossing wingers and creative passing. Their opponents had no clue where to pick them up. That line was one of the greatest lines ever in the history of the game, and it really changed hockey in North America. Hedberg and Nielsen were 2 of the bravest players ever. When they came and played in North America, they were better than a lot of players here, so they got hacked and whacked a ton. When Glenn Sather became coach of the Oilers near the end of the 1976-77 season, he wanted his team to be patterned after what Bobby Hull had built for the Winnipeg Jets. It was a sign that things were getting desperate in the WHA when the Houston Aeros and Winnipeg Jets announced that they were going to merge for the 1978-79 season. The Houston Aeros and the Winnipeg Jets were huge rivals in the WHA. The Jets couldn't stand the Aeros and vice versa. They even fought in the penalty box. Now that rivalry carried over into the Jets' locker room. They didn't play as a team. Their coach, Larry Hillman, once a defenseman with the Maple Leafs, was caught in the middle. He got fired, and Tom McVie came in for the last 19 games. Tom and the club's general manager, John Ferguson, went way back. They'd been friends since they were kids growing up in Vancouver's East Side. McVie was 3 years older, and when he was leaving Bantam and John was just starting, he gave John his old pair of skates. McVie was a workaholic and a rough, gruff coach, In the locker room, the guys would call him Sergeant Major. He would say, "If I can put 18 hours in at the rink, you can put in 2 or 3. The practices were so tough that the players would leave the ice with their tongues hanging out. And their pre-game warm-ups were just as hard. It was like playing 2 games in 1 day. As for Ferguson, he was as tough as they come. He revolutionized the tough guy role by skating shotgun with Jean Beliveau and keeping up. He could play the game with the best of them, but no one was going to take any liberties with Beliveau when Ferguson was on the ice. Finally, one of the players convinced the guys to bring their families and meet at a restaurant so that they could all get to know each other. It pulled them together. They started to play as a team, not as individuals, and they made the playoffs. When Ulf Nilsson and Anders Hedberg went over to the Rangers in 1978, the Jets goalie, Joe Daly, said, "Bobby Hull lost the fingers on his glove." Bobby played only 4 games into the season that year. In 1979, the Jets ended the season on April 18th in third place and were supposed to have a couple of days off before the first round in Quebec against the Nordiques on April 23rd. But Tom called the team in and worked them hard every day. It was not a popular decision. Still, they swept Quebec in 4 games and then got ready to play us, the Edmonton Oilers, for the WHA Championship, the Avco World Trophy. In that playoff series, 4 guys from Winnipeg really stood out for me. The first was their goalie, Gary Smith. When I signed with Indianapolis, Gary was the guy who took me under his wing. He was just tremendous to me. Then, when the Racers folded, the Jets signed Gary as a free agent. He walked into their dressing room with long hair, his shirt untucked, dragging his bag. Then he flopped down on the bench, looked around, and said, "Guys, my name is Gary the Axe Smith. They call me Axe because I've been axed from so many teams. My goals against in Indianapolis was 5.51. But don't let that fool you. I'm not that good." Everybody laughed. But Gary went on to play very well for the Jets. And like all goalies, Gary had some unusual habits. He wore 7 pairs of socks in his skates. But depending on the day, he might pull on up to 14 pairs. After every period, he'd go for a shower. But as soon as the 15 minutes were up, he'd be back on the ice in time for the next period. Kent Nielsen was another top player on the Jets. Kent was a natural. He was such a smooth skater, and his slap shot was unbelievable. He was once challenged on television to hit the crossbar from the red line. He'd tease it up, glances at the net 100 feet away, then calmly cranks it off the crossbar. They called him the Magic Man. Like Kent, Morris Lukowich was a great Jets forward. With Kent and Morris on their team, you knew they'd get a whole lot of points, because Kent had incredible puck-handling skills, and Morris had one of the quickest release wrist shots I've ever seen. A goalie had no time to adjust or square off, and his shot was deadly. Terry Ruskowski was the Jets' natural leader. He was a tremendously hard worker. Unfortunately, though, he hurt his shoulder in Game 3 and missed Games 4 and 5. What happened was, he went against the boards with his elbow up, and then someone hit him from behind and really stretched it. He couldn't lift his arm. But he was back for Game 6 with his shoulder covered in heat and plastic. He had to skate to the bench in warm-up and pull the plastic off because his skin was blistering. Still, he went back out, finished the warm-up, and played very hard. Throughout the game, Terry was giving his defenseman, Barry Long, these nice little saucer passes, and Barry scored twice on them. It was do or die. Terry got 4 assists, and the Jets beat us 7-3. We knew going into the series that it was going to be the last Avco Cup ever. I know we wanted to win and be part of that history. But Winnipeg was just better than we were in those 6 games. The WHA and the NHL had been battling it out for 7 years, and it was costing teams in both leagues. But while some owners thought it only made sense to stop the financial bleeding by joining forces, others couldn't let the hard feelings go. So it took a few years to work out a merger deal between the two leagues. In 1978, a year before the merger, John Ziegler took over for Clarence Campbell as NHL president and discovered that the league was in terrible shape financially. So John pulled the hardliners together and got them talking. It was finally looking like four WHA teams, Edmonton, Quebec, Winnipeg, and Hartford, would be joining the NHL. 13 of the 19 teams had to agree in order for that to happen, and so a vote was held. Ziegler was sure he had the votes, but they lost by one. Harold Ballard, the owner of the Leafs. It turned out that Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver had all voted against adding three new Canadian teams. Once again, it was about television.